The Ronettes here on a Friday edition of the Roundtable. 9:15 on a Friday morning, and Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. You know, we play that music because it is Ronnie Spector's 75th birthday today.
And so, we love the Ronettes.
A shout out to Ronnie Spector on her birthday.
Well, how come they call you Uncle Grumpy?
What do you mean?
Well, because, you know, come on, you start to play that and you made a little face.
Happy birthday to Ronnie Spector, 75 today. And our panel today on the roundtable is, well, this is a good panel. Former EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck is here. Good morning, Judith.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Siena College Economics Professor Aaron Pasitti. You're on time, you're here, and we're excited.
I am compulsively punctual.
Are you ready for the semester to begin?
August is one long Sunday for academics. I know we're
I thought every day was one long Sunday for academics.
I know we're spoiled.
I love that.
But unlike Ray, I did enjoy hearing Phil Spector's Wall of Sound leading us in. Mm,
and you'll hear more of that.
Good.
Also here today, and probably a Ronnie Spector fan as well, Albany County District Attorney David Soares. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Ray. I'm just so happy to be here with you today, seeing as how you have officially wrested the title of the hardest working man in show business from James Brown.
Right. Well, he's dead now, so somebody had to take the job.
Still a difficult task.
The email address here is panel.
Wait.
Oh, yeah, you. Alan Shartok is here as well. Good morning, sir. Now, you know, you're only a year or two older than Ronnie Spector, and yet somehow I feel that you're not that well-versed in her music.
No, I have heard her music.
You have?
And I think she's terrific.
Mm. Did she ever play with Pete Seeger?
I don't think so.
Okay. The email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Keep your letters brief, if you could. No abbreviations, proofread them, don't include links. You know the drill. And one per day per customer. If you have a thought about something we discussed today on the program, prosecutors today expected to rest their case against former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort after, well, it was occasionally dramatic several days of testimony in Manafort's bank fraud and tax evasion trial, some testy exchanges with the trial judge. Prosecuting attorneys for special counsel Robert Mueller got a narrow acknowledgement from U.S. District Judge T.S. Ellis III that he likely erred when he angrily confronted them a day earlier. Yesterday, a group of bank employees told jurors about discrepancies and outright falsehoods in Manafort's loan applications. 20 witnesses in all. And there was that sidebar, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay, but before we do, I wanted to ask David Soares, our district attorney and obviously a lawyer par excellence, what can the judge do to me if I tell you what I really think of him? I mean, can he reach out I told on this panel right from the beginning, I said, this guy, him, I do not like. And it was so clear he was shilling for the Manafort side that it bothered me to death. I really was very upset with him, and he has done nothing to dissuade me. And in fact, very unusually, the prosecutors have been openly arguing with him, David.
Well, I don't know if it's so much openly arguing with the judge, so much as taking a posture that they want reflected in the record in the event that things don't go their way and the matter is appealed. And so there are opportunities that prosecutors dread, in having those kind of public confrontations, but they also recognize that they have to protect the record because should they decide to argue any issue, they want to be able to preserve those matters in the event that, you know, that they win and the other side is eventually going to appeal.
But, David, this guy says to the prosecutors, don't roll your eyes at me.
Well,
that's a little over the top, isn't it?
I think that when you're appearing, you know, before a court, every prosecutor appearing before a particular judge is going to reach out to other practitioners and try to get a feel for how that particular judge runs, you know, his or her court. And they also will ask questions about any idiosyncrasies. Is there a particular, you know, is he going to scold you for chewing gum? How does he like his objections? How does he like for you to object? Prosecutors are going to take the time to speak to other prosecutors and find those things out. The issue, however, for, you know, the difference between, I would say, state judges and federal judges is you're talking appointments that are for life.
Yeah.
And therefore, Whatever personality you get in terms of a judge and in federal courts, you will have to live with that personality.
I've got a subjective question about that, though. Mm-hmm. So what Alan asked was fairly objective. Is he trying to bias the jury in his actions against the prosecution?
I wouldn't read his actions as trying to bias the jury. I would read his actions as attempting. First of all, let me just say this before I answer your question. Let me say this. I think he's recognized that he's become a big part of the case when he shouldn't be a part of the case. Thus, his apology, I think, is his attempt to correct the record and to publicly state that he doesn't favor one side over another, because I think most of the coverage has had him scolding the prosecutors as opposed to scolding the defense. I also believe that judges tend to engage with the prosecution more because we do have the burden of proof. So we're putting on our case first. It's our structure of the case. And so they're going to want to referee and make sure that what we put forth is streamlined, that we're not wasting time. And so I think that the public is going to see a judge engage a prosecutor more in what could be interpreted as, you know, hostile engagements. But I do think that this particular judge, having read newspapers and having family and friends who also read newspapers, probably someone whispered in his ear and said, look, you're becoming a much bigger sideshow to this case than either of the parties, either the defense or the prosecutor. And so maybe you should tone it down. And I think his very public declaration of that perhaps is a reflection of him finally taking some good advice from
friends
and family.
Well, Judith goes first, but then I have something because him I don't like, and I would like to follow up on that.
Thank you, Professor. So I saw an interview with a former U.S. attorney. They're on TV every day now. The former U.S. attorneys are the new stars of this administration. Mm-hmm. And he had cases before this judge numerous times. And he said that this judge is always like this. This is not unique to the Manafort trial, that he's been like this for years. And as David said, you know, attorneys check out who they're in front of, and that this style is not at all unusual for him.
Yeah, but he does seem to be one-sided to me. But here's what. You know, I studied law at in front of the television and
Law and Order.
Law and Order.
Trump University?
Yeah, those things. And, you know, there's always that point at which somebody says something, Sam Waterston or somebody says something, and then the judge says, you know, he rules against them and says, I object, says the defense, and the judge rules against them and he sits down. But that jury heard him say it. So even if he's admonished, this judge, I think, has tainted the pool here. And from the very beginning, when he said, you know, he wanted them to move on and wouldn't let them talk as much as they wanted about the acquisitions and all the things that he had gotten, which they were then going to prove he couldn't pay for, you know, without paying taxes on, I think it was fairly discernible that he was not where he should have been in terms of being a fair jurist.
You know, of course, not having, you know, insight into the people's case and seeing the volume of evidence that they had and as what they could not or were prohibited from presenting. I would say that, you know, this particular judge, recognizing the high profile nature of the case, wanted to put this case together, wanted it, you know, done in what they refer to as the rocket docket fashion. And so the judge, having a preview of the evidence that was going to be presented, probably, and I would say probably correctly so, limited the amount and the volume of evidence that could have been interpreted as, look, it's just more of the same. Mm. And a judge will do that in order to just make the case move along. And probably in many instances, I would say doing the prosecution a favor. I can tell you that in some of our high profile cases where a judge ruled against us, I mean, you come back into the office and you're kicking rocks and you're throwing paper around. But then in hindsight, you're saying, well, he was probably right, because what you don't want to see are jurors, you know, glancing over, paying attention to other things as opposed to your case. And I thought that the prosecution here did a fantastic case of actually breathing life into what would otherwise be a very boring financial crimes case.
The ostrich jacket. Although today will be really interesting because they've been not wanting to talk about President Trump, but the three witnesses today from that small bank in Chicago, the Federal Savings Bank, are talking about how Manafort borrowed, I think, $16 million from this bank and promised the bank president that he would be appointed Secretary of the Army.
Isn't that
in
amazing?
Exchange.
That's the most amazing thing.
And this dude was so delusional that he actually called the Pentagon and asked for some briefings so he could properly prepare for interviews. And so three folks from the bank are going to testify today. And so I guess the prosecution has decided, despite the judge's direction, that President Trump's campaign will be part of the dialogue today.
Well, not necessarily, Judith, because yesterday there was this very interesting discussion with the judge as to whether they would recuse a certain amount of the information which did bring Trump into it, and the judge agreed.
Well, specifically,
those were sealed, right?
That was a sidebar.
Yeah.
Judge Ellis was asked to seal portions of a bench conversation during Gates' testimony because what I'm reading here is substantive evidence in an ongoing investigation was being discussed. Prosecutors didn't elaborate, but one bench conference came after Manafort's defense team tried to question Gates about whether he had discussed his work on the Trump campaign with Mueller's team. And then they went to sidebar, and that was sealed.
Yeah, but I think it's coming in today. They know that these three witnesses are from the bank, and they're going to talk about the play-to-pay scheme here.
The judge is very careful here and was very, I think, clear in the instructions to both the people as well as to the defense. The people are not going to be allowed to present evidence that would bring out a lot of the issues going on right now with the Trump administration in any way to prevent the jury from being prejudiced with all of the issues that we're seeing every day in the news, right? By the same token, the judge is also going to limit the defense's ability to get into questions with a particular witness that is going to veer too much into what's happening right now within this additional investigation.
So what does the defense have, David, which is interesting? They really can't put Manafort on the stand because that would be hell.
I think what the defense strategy was going to be with the people's star witness, Manafort's former assistant and
Gates.
Trusted colleague, Gates.
I think what
they were intending to do was to get into details of the other investigation for which Bob Mueller is specifically in charge of. And they were going to try to elicit, you know, testimony about, you know, whatever it is that he is saying. And the people correctly approached the judge and asked for a sidebar and asked the judge to remind counsel, you know, that these are issues that they can't get into, and to seal the record of anything that has been stated so that any transcript that could be either foiled, that could be provided, that could get out there would not contain any information that could possibly compromise.
Well, we have to go, but before I have one last thing to say of the judge. Him I don't like.
David, we have about 40 seconds here. Explain to me in this day and age why we, the people, cannot see this on TV and have to look at drawings of paintings.
That is one of the most interesting issues in federal court. These are rules that exist that, quite honestly, is high time we rid ourselves of them. You can see a trial in local court. You can see a trial in state courts. You can see arguments in the Court of Appeals and in every state's highest court. You can see a trial. But in the federal system, you're prohibited from doing so, and it makes
full
no
employment
sense.
For Artis Act.
We'll take a break here. The email address is panel@wamc.org. David Soares is here. Aaron Pasitti, Judith Henk, Alan Chartok, and once again, you at panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
good times, we had fun. We drove each.
Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Friday morning. It's 9:34, and Ray is in for Joe, where it's the Roundtable panel. By the way, happy birthday to Ronnie Spector today. You heard her there with Joey Ramone. Alan Shartok is on our panel today. Aaron Pasitti, David Soares, and Judith Enck. And the email address is panel@wamc.org. And I guess we have a couple of letters to read.
Well, we do.
Should you read them?
Yeah. Well, whatever you think. Right, question sir. For David Soares. At what point can the prosecution ask for mistrial? And is that even possible or even an option for the defense? As a prosecutor, I would be worried that the judge jury's overhearing this stuff would be prejudiced. I mentioned that before, yeah. So
I know for the general public that reading about some of the comments that the judge is making throughout the trial, it might seem alarming, but these are the kind of things that prosecutors hear every single day. A judge is going to be critical of something that's happening if whatever it is that's happening isn't, you know, with comporting with the rules of that particular judge's court. Now, in this instance, the people don't have much of an option. You just can't stop midway and say, okay, we want someone else.
But what about the Perry Mason stuff? What about the judge? You shouldn't have said that. I move for a mistrial. Could that happen?
A prosecutor, if he wants to take a chance, could, you know, create a record and ask the judge to recuse himself and lay out the reasons why the prosecutor feels that judge should recuse himself, but doubtful that the judge is going to agree.
No,
that
right.
Not being impartial.
No, but to answer the specific answer to this guy's question is anybody can say anything they want.
It's not going to happen. Yeah. In fact, I think that the prosecution in this case, because it is a financial crimes case and because so much of the evidence exists in the documents. Now, here's my one criticism of the court with respect to this case, and that is there are reports that when the prosecution has sought to publicize the actual record to the jury, they've been denied, and you know they've been told by the judge that the jury could review the documents, you know, while they're deliberating, which is a blow to the prosecution because if we're making a point about a particular bank record, what we want to do is the minute we've gotten this record introduced, you know, at trial, we want to publicize it to the jury so the jury can see the record and make a mental note. And then when they go back to deliberate, they can go back to that same record and know exactly what the prosecutor was talking about in that moment in trial. So I think that if there's a disadvantage here based upon the rulings from this particular judge, it's going to be in the judges deciding not to allow the prosecution to publicize records.
And let's remember that there are 12 individuals sitting there, six women, six men, I believe. They are not the sharpest tacks necessarily in the box. And in fact, quite frequently, they either have to feign or announce that they know nothing about nothing when they're being picked for the jury. I know nothing. So I'm still thinking this could be bad for the prosecution.
Yes, it could be because sometimes, I mean, you could present something that appears to be very common sense, you know, to you as a prosecutor, but then the risk is you are, you know, for the first time introducing concepts, you know, about tax evasion to people who, you know, may not understand that. But so much of this case rests on the ability of the people to actually communicate, you know, what their case is about, you know, clearly, so that that anyone, even if you're not a sharp tack, you're going to understand.
But you've just made the very good point that in this case, the jury has not been allowed to be properly inculcated with that information.
At the time it's being presented.
Yes.
But the narrative, though, has been so clear here. I mean, it's tax fraud, it's multiple bank fraud. I think every juror got it.
And they can probably connect the dots between money laundering, tax fraud.
Well, let me ask our
It's going to change the prosecution's closing somewhat, I believe, because now, while they were deprived from publishing the actual record to the jury as they were speaking about it, they will now have to perhaps enhance their closing to show the juror that record and point them to it. And they could even say things like, know, while you're deliberating, take a close look at line four, right?
Okay, well, that's my question. When it finally goes to the jury, is there a method? In other words, an assault trial, somebody's stabbed, the prosecution said, okay, here's the wound, the blood was on the alleged assailant, simple. But this is some arcane stuff here. And when the jury is deliberating, is there a mechanism that both sides can agree upon where someone can coach them and say, well, you're looking at this. You have to look at this part of the document and not this part. Because most people will hold it up and just kind of blankly look at it and say, oh, yeah, that's the document.
The jurors are in the room by themselves. They're going to deliberate.
If you have
an effective closing, and believe you me, I think these are the best of the best in the world of financial crimes. This particular U.S. Attorney's Office, these particular prosecutors are the best of the best. So during their closing, they're going to go through Economics 101, Banking 101, Embezzlement 101. They're going to instruct, they're going to educate the jurors during their closing. And the jurors will go back. And if the jurors have a question, they will write that question to the judge. And then the judge may, in fact, get the jurors back out and have an answer, have the prosecutor have an answer from the record read back to the jurors so that they can get clarity and then return to their work.
So Barbara writes, I think that this judge knows that if the jury convicts Manafort, there will be a criticism of the procedure by the right as, quote, rigged from the start. Appearing to be stern with the prosecution from the get-go was his way of short-circuiting that eventual criticism. Well, you can think what you want, but let's remember he was appointed by Ronald Reagan.
He was appointed by Ronald Reagan, but I have to listen, as an officer of the court, as a person who has faith in our system, I have to believe, and I do believe that judges don't see those things, and just like criminals don't ask you for your political affiliation before they victimize you. I don't believe that judges play that kind of politics while they're making these decisions.
Anyway, Gary agrees about the judge's behavior may help reduce the points that the talking heads on Fox News can make about the case. That's what he's saying. So agreeing with the last person. And Space Force. What do the Space Force and the border wall have in common? Both are ill-conceived ideas, playing to ignorant xenophobes. Both will cost vast amounts of money. Both will leave a lot of rubbish, pollution, and ugliness wherever they are located, and neither has the chance of efficacy or utility. Anyone who has lived through the past 2 years in the United States would assume both are jokes. Thank you for another great program, and that's Laurie.
Well, we'll discuss the Space Force coming up here on the program.
I just want to be called Star-Lord if we're going to be discussing
Star-Lord.
Anything
I like
about
that.
Space.
I want to be called Tom Corbett.
You kind of remind me of
I want to be called Hal.
What?
Hal. I think Hal. We should call Alan Emperor Palpatine. What do you think?
Yeah.
No? The email Space address here cadet. Is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, if you would like to join in the conversation today. Tell you what there, Mike Bowen, the engineer. We'll take a fast break here, and then we'll talk about an appeals court decision involving the EPA. That's next. Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Friday morning, 9:44. Ray Graff here with you and the panel, and what a great panel today. We have Albany County DA David Soares is here, Judith Enck, former EPA regional administrator, Siena College economics professor, every day is Sunday for Aaron Pasitti, and our own Alan Shartok. Welcome back to the festivities here. A federal appeals court has ruled that the Trump administration endangered public health by keeping a widely used pesticide on the market, despite extensive scientific evidence that even tiny levels of exposure can harm babies' brains. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco on Thursday ordered the EPA to remove chlorpyrifos. Okay. I looked it up, and it online said pyrifos.
Chlorpyrifos.
Okay, I have a feeling you have some
Trust
experience
me.
With this. Anyway, they've removed it for sale. They're ordered to remove it for sale in the U.S. within 60 days. Coalition of farm workers and environmental groups sued last year after then EPA Chief Scott Pruitt reversed an Obama-era effort to remove them. It's widely sprayed on citrus and apples and such. Mm-hmm. Is that correct,
Judith? And almonds, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was a split decision yesterday, and they said that Pruitt violated federal law by ignoring the conclusions of of agency scientists that chlorpyrifos. Okay, it's harmful. Mm-hmm. Explain your background with this, Judith Enck, and then what happened?
Yeah, so, you know, kudos to the New York Attorney General's office. They've been on this for probably 20 years, 15 years. I worked on this when I was there. This is a very toxic organophosphate pesticide that's designed to damage your central nervous system and the brains of bugs. And it does the same thing to people. There's a, you know, we talked about the record in the Manafort trial. There is a gigantic record in science that this is a very, very harmful pesticide, one of many. And during the Obama administration, there was a regulation to ban it. Scott Pruitt decided to ignore the science, to ignore his own EPA staff, and stopped the ban. Thankfully, state attorneys general and environmental groups like Earth Justice challenged in court. It's not surprising to me that the court ruled this way, but it is such a relief, because this is not only very, very toxic to farm workers, but there's often residue on certain foods. And so within 60 days, this product will be banned. I would take it a step further. I think all organophosphate pesticides should be banned. These are a real threat to human health. I think getting chlorpyrifos off the market within 60 days is extraordinarily important. But I, you know, I've had lots of experience dealing with pesticide poisoning cases. When I was at EPA, I remember one in particular. I was on the train coming home from a long day in Washington, got a call about a teenager who's fallen into a coma because he was exposed to methyl bromide. And I remember saying, what? We banned methyl bromide years ago for use except at airports when they're quarantining fruits and vegetables. What happened is a very large pesticide company, a chain, applied methyl bromide at a luxury apartment complex in vacation complex in St. John, U.S. Virgin Islands, on the first floor. On the second floor was a family of four from Delaware on vacation. The methyl bromide went up to the second floor, and it wasn't just one teenager that fell into a coma. It was also his brother, and then eventually the dad. So the all four family members were in the hospital. The teenagers and the father eventually came out of the comas. They now have permanent neurological damage. They are in wheelchairs. They cannot speak. They cannot communicate because of one illegal pesticide application one time. So, you know, there are tens of thousands of pesticides on the market. Many of them are neurotoxins. Many are carcinogens. I think the judge's decision, the court decision here was smart, but it's really just the beginning, and it should really prompt a very detailed analysis of why do we have such highly toxic legal products on the market when they cause tremendous damage to human health.
So this was this banned during the Obama administration?
Yes, and it was reversed by Scott Pruitt.
Okay, and so how long was it banned? I know it was developed in the 60s.
Not long. Okay. There were partial bans in place. What often happens is you rarely have a straight-out ban. It's banned for certain uses.
Right, because as I understand, millions of pounds are sold every year of this stuff.
For agriculture.
Right.
Not for residential use. And so the Obama administration said you can no longer use it for agriculture. It is entirely banned. Scott Pruitt came in and decided to reverse that policy, that regulation.
And since it was developed in the 60s, what sort of Have we seen widespread effects? I mean, it's been in the marketplace in one way or another for 50 years.
Right. We've seen widespread problems, and that's why the Obama administration did a regulation to permanently ban it.
Why did it take so long that the Obama administration had to do it?
The pesticides lobby is very influential in Washington.
And you know something? I'm listening to you tell the story about this family, and I think that's the – I think that – is the narrative that, people just don't hear as often as they should. Because most times that people hear about these environmentalists and these cases and the banning of certain products, there's an eye roll.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say, oh, it's just – they're trying to save a moth, or they're trying to save some kind of caterpillar somewhere. When in truth, you're trying to prevent, you know, human beings from being exposed. And you know – I was going to ask the question, quite honestly, when we were off the air, but I was going to ask the question as to whether or not the same pesticide industries have also obtained, you know, very favorable laws that prevent or place limitations on the ability of the victims to recover after, you know, lawsuits. And that's usually what follows.
Yeah, that has... I'm not familiar with that. The family that I'm talking about, and this has been widely reported in the press, the Delaware family, the Esmond family, they had a private attorney who got them a private settlement. When I was at EPA, we brought an enforcement case against Terminex. We got the largest penalty, I think, in history. The applicator may go to jail, but none of that really matters when you think about this family whose lives are permanently destroyed. There are hundreds of thousands of reported pesticide poisonings every year in this country. Most go unreported. But to your question, David, so far there has not been a successful effort to close the courthouse doors to, people who are damaged by pesticides.
Wait. Just for those of us who employ Terminex at our homes, you just mentioned Terminex. It was their use of the chemical that
yes.
was prohibited, right? That you got a judgment against. It wasn't.
They violated the law by using methyl bromide, which you're not supposed to use in residential uses.
Right. When the guy comes in the next time, I'll say, by the way, you got any of that stuff?
Oh, gosh.
Are you going to sell it on the black market?
The email address, if you want to complain,
sure.
panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Indeed
you
it
know,
is.
It's, you know, your story here is very compelling, and it's very powerful, and I just wonder why we don't hear about these, you know, the collateral consequences to these unsafe products being used. And sure, I think part of the problem is we have our Congress that is completely bought out by so many of these industries, whether it's agri-farms or pharmaceuticals. It's just terrible.
And a lot of the pesticide poisoning, I mean, the real story that I just told, which I think about quite often, was a dramatic ending. You know, three people in wheelchairs who can't speak and live their lives. A lot of times the pesticide poisoning is you have a headache, you have a rash, and you don't connect it to, oh, I just, you know, my father just sprayed something in the bedroom. I wonder why I'm not feeling well. And a lot of this is just not documented. Yeah. And the irony is there, of course, you have to deal with pest problems, but there's something called integrated pest management where you can deal with pest problems without using cancer-causing or neurotoxic chemicals.
My wife just yells, and that's effective.
She yells at the bugs, or does she yell at
man,
you?
Man, she yells at everything, and her pitch, you know.
Ooh.
You know, it's so funny. We went up to the zoo when we were on vacation.
Did you?
And one of the...
I'm opposed to zoos.
This was a very good zoo, and I forget the monkey that was involved, but it has a very loud yell.
Oh, the howler monkey.
And it would yell into the ground, and the bugs would come out. Isn't that interesting?
I've never heard that. I don't know if that's the howler monkey, but
well, they know
who
what
knows?
To do. They know how to get them bugs, and
food.
Then they eat them.
So maybe
nature,
the pesticide companies should be using monkeys.
Monkeys. Nature is an amazing thing.
But getting back to the lobbying effort, you talked about the lobbying effort for years. This chemical, chlorpyrifos or pyrifos, whatever
depends
you want to
depends if you're from the central part of our country or from the East Coast.
Yeah,
I think
right.
you got the pronunciation.
Or the Bronx.
The company that developed it, which was Dow, in the 60s. Now, as I understand it, this is loosely, it's in the same chemical group as Nerve gas.
Yes, it's an organophosphate pesticide.
How, even given the vast amounts of money that you can lobby with, on what justification can you say, well, you know what, this is going to be fine, and then have it be in play for 45 years?
Well, you have to get your pesticide registered by the EPA, and you come in with a mountain of science that says if used properly, it's not going to cause adverse health effects.
Is that true?
Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. I mean, we have tens of thousands of registered pesticides.
Well, we're just talking about this one.
Yeah, this one. No, I don't think this is true at all. I think we've known about this problem for years, and your point, Ray, is it should have been banned long before the Obama
administration. Well, I'm just wondering what justification, scientific justification, one could use if one was lobbying in favor of its continued use.
They say, you know, it works. And it does. It kills a lot of bugs. And the pesticide law is pretty weak. Don't get me going on FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act. It is weak.
I would just pay money to just hear that one more time.
FIFRA.
And then, of course, there's the land of rumor. I mean, we all know that there are those things that grow up between the cracks in our walks and things. And
weeds? Dandelions?
What do you call those? They call them, yeah.
And then you hear, don't use that. That stuff is bad for you. Mm-hmm. But that stuff is all around and everybody uses it, right?
And it gets into, there's heavy, heavy pesticide use just for lawn care. I mean, that's the stuff that's easy. Mm-hmm. If you've got some kind of infestation, sometimes you do need to carefully use pesticides. But, you know, using highly toxic pesticides to kill dandelions, or if you don't want to pick weeds, why take that chance? Because your kid, your grandkid, your dog is going to be rolling around on the lawn. There's just no
need
for
it. I'm going to get a howler monkey myself.
I love howler monkey.
I don't think it was a howler monkey.
No. Could you bring them into the studio when you get them?
You know, I'm just going to continue using that. Do not get me going on FIFRA. But you know, you raise a good point that, first of all, there's been an assault on science, and you know, that dates back in certain industries, tobacco being one of them, right? Mm-hmm. Pesticide industry, climate. But there's been an assault on science in many of those industries. I think right now we've seen an assault on science and many others. We're just getting used to hearing about it in climate and in other areas right now.
Can
that's
I
how
just,
they've combated
a
that.
A quick local example. The Albany County Legislature is considering banning polystyrene food containers for restaurants. And there's actually a hearing this Monday night at 6:15 at the Albany County Courthouse. I testified at the last hearing and simply said that styrene is a suspected carcinogen. It's widely known. It's documented. The lobbyist for the American Chemistry Council gets up after me and says, that is incorrect. Styrene is not a suspected carcinogen.
Now, I really want to read this because I think Ray deserves a chance.
We only have about 30 seconds.
Okay. Sounds like Ray was implying that because this dangerous pesticide has been in use for over 50 years, it couldn't be that bad.
No, not at all. Not at
that
all.
Is dangerous.
I was asking on what basis was it allowed to continue.
Yeah, political influence.
All right. Well, you know, let's leave it there. And the email address is panel@wamc.org. Why are you looking at me that way? You have something else to say?
I'm looking at it there because of the immense respect I feel in my heart and my brain for you.
Pinocchio. All right. We'll take a break and then we'll come back.
Great music.
Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. Hey, it's Ronnie Spector's 75th birthday today. It's the Roundtable panel. Ray in for Joe, and we have Albany County District Attorney David Soares here, Siena College Economics Professor Aaron Pasitti, former EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck, and WAMC's own Alan Shartok. And, of course, you're welcome to join in the fun by sending us a brief email, and the address is panel@wamc.org.
Here's my favorite of the day.
Okay.
It's addressed to David. It begins, Mr. Soares.
Oh, nice. You billionaire DAU.
Can I have a loan? Alleged collusion between WikiLeaks and Russia and the Mueller investigation began with the publication of the DNC and Podesta emails by WikiLeaks. Why has Julian Assange been summoned for an interview with the Senate Intelligence Committee, but not for an interview by Robert Mueller?
First of all, Julian Assange is taking up residence in a South American embassy and out of the reach of the United States government. And I believe that should Ecuador decide to evict Mr. Assange, he will be picked up and brought to this country to answer for the misdeeds of WikiLeaks.
Okay, here's another one from Jamie who says, I'm only going to read the first sentence, Ray, if that's all right with you. What I find the most frightening about the actions and lies of the Trump cabal is that they demonstrate no remorse for their illegal and immoral behavior. And a listener in Utah says, I was completely disgusted to hear about Trump's tweet about the California wildfires. He said in his tweet that the wildfires are made worse because of bad environmental laws. We need serious and immediate environmental response from the White House and not these ridiculous comments. And Susan says, hi, Judith.
Hi, Susan.
How can we?
Well played.
How can we flip the current process of allowing pesticides and chemicals such as those in cosmetics and food chain into the consumer chain before they are tested? We Americans are the test subject. And the answer to that shortly is?
We need to change the law so it has to be proven that it's not going to damage your health, which is the way it works for cosmetics, but not pesticides.
Doesn't it always come back to the same thing, though, Judith? It's about paying attention to your local politics. It's about paying attention to the candidates that are running because you just can't change the law. You have to elect people to change the law.
Yes, we need our members of Congress to change the law or change the president. Mm-hmm. That would be even better.
Alan says, Pruitt arrested. Can Scott Pruitt be charged for such actions?
You know, what's interesting here is, we know that when there are internal, IG investigations, those investigations tend to terminate once the person has left the position.
Sure.
What's interesting is to see whether or not anyone from the U.S. Attorney's Office has been paying attention to these investigations and conducting their own.
Well, it's also an interesting question as to whether Collins, up there in Buffalo, Collins, right?
Collins.
Yeah. Whether Collins up there in Buffalo is staying with his election so that when the time comes, he'll have a card to play by stepping aside.
Right. That's often
I believe
what
they he do. Has said he is not intending to get out of the race.
He's
Well, as Alphonse D'Amato once said, that was this now, but that was then, not now.
I think you also have to understand this from the perspective. Mm-hmm. First of all, there's a presumption of innocence here. For him to step down, the public appearance would be that he's stepping down because he believes he's done something wrong.
Right.
That's why what we've started to see, I think, over the last 15 years, when an elected official has been arrested and he takes a booking photo, that photo looks like the kind of photo that you're seeing on campaign literature because they're smiling. Mm-hmm. And all of that is designed to give the public appearance that they haven't done anything wrong.
Okay. I want to go back to the point, though, can Pruitt be arrested? I mean, some of his ethical violations are continuing to be examined by the Inspector General at EPA, but I don't think he's going to be charged for allowing chlorpyrifos to continue on the market. And in fact, I read some articles where when Pruitt met with the chemical industry, he said to them, this is a new day. Mm-hmm. And in the meeting, there's a guy who I think is still at the EPA who said to the chemical companies that they want to have, quote, a new relationship with industry based on partnerships, not on regulations and enforcement. So they're very open about not wanting to interfere with the business of, say, selling pesticides.
Well, I just want to be clear that when I was talking about Pruitt, I was speaking more in terms of the Honest Services Statute. And I think when you're leveraging your position in an effort to obtain a Chick-fil-A, which I want to say here, I love Chick-fil-A.
And I wonder if they're going to do that franchise now, Pruitts, out of work.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. If there's an investigation into whether or not there were any promises, quid pro quos, for obtaining a Chick-fil-A franchise, he could have some criminal exposure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
And Chris says, pesticides, Rush Limbaugh calls environmentalists wackos. No wonder there is so much apathy. Well, I don't know that one is directly tied to the other. I think if Rush Limbaugh is calling people like Judith Ink, our wonderful Judith Ink, a wacko, it would tend to get people more activated than than apathetic.
Would certainly get Judith more active.
Rush Limbaugh doesn't want to get Judith going on Fifth Row. I'll tell you that right now.
Not on Fifth Row. Just a real quick observation. Yes, within certain quarters, there is tremendous hostility toward environmental advocates, but this is a funny experience I had when I made a point of meeting with all of the members of Congress that represent my EPA region. And even the most anti-environmental members of Congress, when I met with them, they always asked me, could you do something about this environmental problem in my district? Do you have funding for this sewage treatment plant? And it was kind of like there was the rhetoric, and then they want their own district protected. Yeah. And of course, I would take those requests seriously. And every so often, especially my final year, I said, you know, it'd be really good for you to sync up your public statements attacking EPA with your request for us to step in to clean up your Superfund site.
And Anita says, Anita, is it possible that Trump doesn't care a hoot about his Space Force ever coming to fruition as long as he can claim having put hundreds more people back in the workforce? Will these federal employees be to replace the truly essential Fed employees that he has tossed out in the guise of saving our tax money? Well, no, I think another possibility is that even though this might not happen, he thinks he gets credit for having tried. So who knows? Okay, and then finally, Alan, I'll give you Tom Corbett. Most of you people are way too young to remember Tom Corbett, Space Cadet, from the television, very early television. But I have dibs on Flash Gordon. Now, there's a real spacer. Right. Okay, Bob. Okay, move along. Bobby says, Bennington PFOA contamination, a new article in the VT, Vermont Digger, and a publication from Bennington College has indicated that the PFOA contaminated area of Bennington Shaftesbury is larger than previously thought. What are the short-term remediation strategies for this type of contamination? And that's from Bobby in Bennington.
Well, it's a great report that Bennington College put out showing airborne PFOA affecting soil and potentially groundwater. So it's a large, large area, and we've got Hoosick Falls next to Bennington and near Petersburg. All three communities have a lot of PFOA contamination, so they need to be remediated through the federal and state Superfund program, and it's going to take a very long time.
It's the Roundtable panel today, and we have Judith Enck with us, David Soares, Aaron Pasitti, and Alan Shartok, pointing to growing threats and competition from Russia and China. The White House Thursday announced plans to create the U.S. Space Force as a sixth separate military warfighting service by 2020. Vice President Pence announced the new force yesterday during a Pentagon speech. Citing Russia and China, he said that for years, U.S. adversaries have pursued weapons to jam, blind, and disable our navigation and communication satellites via electronic attacks from the ground. As their actions make clear, our adversaries have transformed space into a warfighting domain already, and the U.S. will not shrink from this challenge. Space Force.
Alan. Space Force.
What do you mean, Alan?
So I'm not a military expert here, and it'd be nice to have Malcolm here to talk about this. But, you know, the amount of reliance that not only the U.S. population but the U.S. government has on satellites is could pose a legitimate threat. I actually laughed this morning or yesterday when I saw this article because $8 billion, that is 1% of the federal defense budget. So if Pence and Trump think that they can protect space and the satellites, you know, and provide intergalactic security for 1% of the space, for 1% of the defense budget is absolutely laughable. The U.S. government spends $1 out of every $6 on national defense. We spend twice as much as every industrialized country in the world. And this just seems like, I mean, if you're going to do something like that, it needs to be more than $8 billion over 5 years.
So, but Aaron, the whole point here is take that $8 billion or whatever you're going to put towards this and give it to the Air Force and tell them to spend it correctly as opposed to setting up a whole new bureaucracy, which has a huge
amount.
Or
NASA.
Yeah.
I have a very hard time. I have a very hard time accepting that the same administration that doesn't perceive Russia as a threat in cyberspace is now ready to combat Russia in real space.
Well,
I have a hard time accepting that an administration who hasn't engaged China in the property rights over the Southeast China Seas is going to now want to take on Russia, China in space. I think it's another, hey, look up there while there's trials going on and investigations going on. And boy, I just want to be Commander Star-Lord.
And let's not forget about Russia's active military presence in the Arctic now, where the U.S. is. Right. What does the U.S. Navy have? One icebreaker from the 1960s?
I mean,
it's ignoring these much more tangible, immediate threats.
Aren't you curious whose idea this was? Because I don't think this was Trump's idea. I think some, you know, defense industry lobbyist came up with this idea. I mean, Secretary
I was going to say
Mattis
Elon Musk, because he must need an infusion.
Yeah,
you know, here's the other thing. It's like we've decided as a nation that funding NASA was no longer a priority for us.
Right.
So how is it that all of a sudden we're ready to go take on and create a special force?
And Mattis,
for
Secretary of Defense Mattis, last year wrote to Congress saying this was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. So where did this idea originate?
Well, they put Pence up there before the lectern to make the announcement.
And it was like the most boring speech in the history of the world.
I wonder why.
With all due respect to our learned panel, we're doing this already. We have the Air Force Space Command already, 38,000-plus personnel doing this. This is just changing the... taking the space away from the Air Force and creating a new thing. And that $8 billion is just a starter fund. And then presumably you take some of that Air Force budget, move it over to the Space Command.
No, they're going to want more money. They're not going to use existing funding.
So much of that has been an investment in technology for satellites. Because, you know, the 21st century wars aren't going to take place with people holding weapons and pointing it and shooting it. It's going to be buttons. It's going to be little planes that fly over. And you need navigation systems. So much of what we do now is to support the tools that we have for war today.
But Ray, they need to go to Congress, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I would like to read a very important letter from Michael, who says, comments about the jury. Remember my comments about the jury and that all it takes is one. Alan's comments, juries are bigoted and ignorant. I joined jurors on a rape trial, many of whom had no college degrees. They were thoughtful and considered difficult evidence during a time when people still use the excuse that she deserved it. That argument never saw the light of day, and we convicted the guy of rape. Rape is very different than a very complex question as to mortgages and who did this and transferred this or that. So I would reject your point about my being bigoted and ignorant. If I were a much younger person, I would say, no, you're the bigoted and ignorant person.
Look, we have a system. Our system of jurisprudence is such that, you know, 12 people are going to be sitting in a box. They're 12 people that you don't know. We ask a lot of them to come in. It's really up to us to provide the education into the subject matter that we're trying. Now, I will tell you this. Financial crimes, white-collar crimes, tax cases. Tax cases are some of the most difficult cases to present, not just because of the complexity of taxes, but because it's really not a sexy subject matter. When there's a victim associated, people are emotionally invested. But when we're talking about numbers, people tend to say, hey, what's the big deal here? Well, the big deal here is that we're all losing out as a community.
And that's intangible.
Hello. I didn't know you wanted me to read more. Sonar. Lake treatments. The Berkshire towns are considering treating lakes and ponds with sonar and herbicide to control the weed milfoil. Great Barrington treated a pond yesterday and put a notice on local radio for citizens not to consume or cook the water from the lake. Additionally, we were told not to let livestock come in contact with that water for a few days. Do any panel members know anything about sonar?
Yes. It's a terrible idea to put sonar into your lake or your pond. There's this dilemma that there's so much phosphorus and nitrogen coming off of the land into the water. You get all this excess vegetative growth, and you often can't conveniently swim or boat, so people want to get rid of all the vegetation in the lakes. But I would take a look at what Tupper Lake in the Adirondacks did many years ago, which is it's expensive. You put down mats to block the sunlight. I would try that first.
Yeah, but if there's snails in the lake, as it just happened in Pittsfield, a couple of snails, you know, you don't want to do that because you would kill the snails.
Well, that's a separate issue of endangered snails that we talked a few weeks ago, and I continue to be with the snails.
Of course.
But I would do everything possible to avoid applying
however,
sonar.
What is sonar?
I would do.
It's an herbicide. It's an aquatic herbicide.
That's a brand name?
Yeah, and it attempts to, I don't know if it's the brand name or the chemical name, but it attempts to kill excess vegetation.
Milfoil. We will have a problem with milfoil. The Tanglewood Bowl has it. Lake Mansfield, where I live, literally a block from the lake, has it. But the one thing you're not allowed to do that I have always questioned, although I'm sure you'll have a good answer, Judith, is to put a milfoil-eating carp into the lake, and that Asian carp, and that is prohibited.
For good reason.
And what's the good reason?
Well, this carp is an invasive species, and then it's affecting the whole ecology of the
lake. Eat the snails.
Well, not just that, but have you seen those Asian carp? They can
wild. All I'm saying is, and granted, this is not based on any kind of science. I think the solution for so many of these things happened to be the hollering monkey. I think
I'm for that. I'm going out right now.
If you've ever been to Costa Rica, which I highly recommend, you will be awakened at the same time every day by these screeching howler monkeys that go online and listen to them.
Well, get one, but don't get two.
You will be blown away at how loud they are. And I think for the size, they're the loudest creature on the earth.
I thought that was Alan.
You stole my joke.
But we do, on our hill, we do have a rooster. We have a rooster, and the rooster makes a lot of noise. So I think, you know, it would be appropriate to have
Get a howler monkey.
I'm going to get myself one.
I thought you were against zoos. Is that a...
No, I'm not against, I'm against zoos.
Free-range howler monkey.
This monkey could go anywhere.
I love the howler monkeys. They're just so loud in the morning.
All? You know, on that happy note, let's end the program.
That's all?
That's it, buddy old boy.
There was a really nice letter in here about you and your stewardship, and I want to compliment you. How well you've done.
If you're lucky, I'll come back Monday and do it again. We'll see.
Is Joe out again Monday?
He might be. I'm not sure. The jury is out on that. Well, speaking of jury, thanks to Albany County DA David Storrs for being here, and to former EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck, Siena College Economics Professor Aaron Pacitti, and America's pal Alan Chartok for being with us. You're listening to The Roundtable. Remember, it's Ronnie Spector's 75th birthday. Send her a card. We'll be back.